Let's introduce chapter 13. And I thought I'd start out here. I mean, I just found this out. I got an email, what was it, Friday night from Astronomy Magazine. And I had submitted a photo last August for consideration. And an editor wrote me late Friday night. He says, oh, by the way, we've selected your picture of the Ring Nebula as our photo of the day for tomorrow, Saturday. Photo of the day. Here's my picture. You don't see my name there. You have to click on it. This is what you see. So there's my name there and my picture of the Ring Nebula. That was taken with that was one of the first pictures I took with my new 15-inch Ritchie Cretan telescope. That is a very small object in the sky. It's an example of a planetary nebula. And we'll talk in this very chapter about that phenomenon. There's the Hubble Space Telescope picture of the same object, the Ring Nebula. $2 billion telescope in space. Mine's only half that cost in my driveway. But you see what I mean? Look at what the amazing revolution in equipment where an amateur can produce images that at least rival those of the greatest telescopes on or above the Earth. In fact, some would say that's a better image. But anyway, you know, the key is with the Ring Nebula, can you see the central stars? See those two stars there in the middle? The middle star is a white dwarf. That's a star only about the size of our sun. It's a star that started out about the size of our sun, and now, because it's burned up its fuel and it's contracted down to about the size of our Earth, so it's contracted by a factor of about 1,000,000, it has a density of about 10 tons per teaspoon. Now think about that for a minute. And yet it's still gaseous. And the reason that it stopped contracting is electron degeneracy, meaning that the electron orbits were starting to be in contact with each other. And this gets you right into a principle called the Pauli exclusionary principle, named after the Austrian physicist Wolfgang Pauli. Do you understand? If you slap your hand on this table, why does it stop? Why doesn't it go through the table? If you clap your hands, why don't your hands go through each other? Why can't we walk through the door? Why do we have to open it? Why am I standing here and not falling through the earth? Why is it that we have elements other than hydrogen? The very periodic table itself. These are all functions of the Pauli exclusionary principle. And what it says is this. Baryons, you know, physical matter, electrons, neutrons, protons, cannot occupy the same space. And typically, electrons, those orbits. Electrons will not share those orbits with other electrons. It's a wall that's almost impenetrable. And that's what keeps you sitting there with your feet on the floor and not collapsing in to the center of the Earth. Think about that. Clapping your hand. Hitting the desk. Why doesn't your hand go right through the desk? The exclusionary principle. What's happening? Electron orbits are in contact and they're resisting going any further concentration. If it weren't for the exclusionary principle, that's another, may I say, anthropic principle. If it weren't for this principle, can you imagine life existing when we would all fall to the center of the Earth instantly, where no matter would be possible other than hydrogen? Now, he did say, Pauli said that the exclusionary principle does not apply to radiation. And that's why radiation, you can go to the doctor and have an X-ray. The X-rays go through the baryonic material. They're not stopped by it, right? Light, the same. You can shine a flashlight through a piece of glass, but you can't put your hand through it. But anyway, what you're seeing here is a white dwarf star in the center of the Ring Nebula, which is the remnant of a star that blew up and created this bubble, this nebula that we see surrounding it called the Ring Nebula. The reason that star stopped at the size of the Earth was because it was less than 1.4 times the size of the Earth. That's called the Chandrasekhar limit. We'll talk about it later in this chapter. But stars less than 1.4 solar masses will eventually shrink down when they burn up their fuel, contract down to the size of basically the Earth, and then they're halted by what's called electron degeneracy. It's the Pauli exclusionary principle. Those electron orbits become in contact. It's just like slamming the desk with your hand. And all of a sudden, the contraction stops dead in its tracks, and you get a rebound effect of this beautiful nebula that emerges. Okay? Now, if the star starts out more than 1.4 times the size of our sun, there's enough mass there to contract down through the Chandrasekhar limit, and it'll crush through the white dwarf stage. And depending on the initial mass of the star, it will end up as a neutron star or a black hole, as we'll see later. But look at there, in this Hubble Space Telescope image. Which picture is it easier to see that white dwarf? Well, you can judge for yourself. If you want extra credit, say this one. Okay. Oh, yes. You know, in my family, we never had a television up until just a few years ago. So our kids were all raised without television. So we had to do all kinds of things together as a family. One of the things we enjoyed doing on occasion was reading Shakespeare's plays and assigning parts to people. I love playing Hamlet myself. But here's a great play, As You Like It. This great soliloquy on the stages of man. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances. Let's see if I can say this from memory. And one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. Then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail unwillingly to academic building too. And then the lover, sighing like furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress' eyebrow. Then a soldier, full of strange oaths, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation, even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, in fair round belly with good cap unlined, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances. And so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shrink, and his big manly voice turning again toward childish treble, pipes, and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all, that ends this strange eventful history, is second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. What are we talking about? Not the seven stages of man, but the stages of the life of a star. The current model, all stars of up to 10 to 15 solar masses, and this is not known with great precision where the cutoff is here, so we're going to be kind of loose. I think the textbook may talk about 15. Some texts say 10. So I'm going to say roughly 10 to 15 solar masses. This is somewhat fluid, and it's not. There's no agreement with great specificity with regard to this model. But so we'll say stars of up to 10 to 15 solar masses, that's the mass of our sun, evolve in a similar manner. Their life cycle is the same. Red giants are stars of up to 10 to 15 solar masses. They spend 90%, or stars spend 90% of their life on the main sequence through proton fusion. What makes them leave the main sequence and come up here in this green circle and become cooler and brighter giants? Well, let's take a look at the mass and the lifetime on the main sequence in years. For an O-class star, it's about 40 times, on average, the mass of our sun. It's only on the main sequence for about 1 million years. It's up here. And quickly burns up because it's so huge. And then you go down to the next class, the B, 16 times, roughly the size of our sun. It's on the main sequence for 10 million. Remember we said last time that what astronomers do is they take the main sequence of star clusters, and they can estimate the age of the cluster by how many stars you see here in the O, B, A, and even F spectral classifications. Those are big stars. They have short lives. If you don't see any O, B, or A stars, you know that that's a relatively, well, it's getting to be older star cluster. If you're looking for life, you better be looking at G and K class stars, because these other stars burn up too fast. And the G and K stars class, the G stars, like our sun, comprise only 8% of all stars. The K class stars comprise only 13%. So the best candidates for life-supporting stars having a solar system, you're only looking at about 1 out of 5 stars in the universe. All right, we'll just conclude with this slide here, and we'll pick up with this next time as well. But as I said, the hydrogen in the main sequence star's core is eventually burned up through fusion. And what does that leave? It leaves this inert helium core here, which is the unburnt helium, roughly 10 to 15% of the mass of the star. But it's not hot enough to fuse helium. You know, we said it takes 10 to 15 million degrees Kelvin for hydrogen to fuse into helium. But it takes 100 million degrees Kelvin for helium to fuse into carbon or oxygen. So this is a much hotter temperature. And so for many stars, they just end up with this inert, unfused helium core here, which is surrounded by this lighter shell of fusing hydrogen. And then the whole thing is surrounded by this red bloated area of this extended envelope. With no fusion occurring here in the core, because the temperature's not hot enough, the hydrostatic equilibrium is affected. We're not having any energy outflowing enough to overcome and to resist the inward crush of gravity. And so what happens is the star begins to shrink. And as it does, that gravitational contraction raises the temperature in the core, and the temperature starts to rise. And that rising temperature radiates heat outward, and it begins to fuse some of that hydrogen shell, the gas surrounding that shell, to fuse and expand, expanding this envelope greatly. And that produces the red giant stage with that huge envelope of very diffuse hydrogen gas, unfused hydrogen gas. And that's why those stars are in the upper right-hand corner of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, the upper right-hand corner, because they're high in luminosity, but they're low in temperature. They're huge stars, maybe with a diameter equal to the diameter of Mercury or Venus, for example, the orbits of those planets. With that incredible size, they inevitably cool. The exterior cools down, and that's why it turns red, because the red under Wien's law is associated with cooler temperature. And that forms the red giant star. And then next week we'll begin by looking at how the star eventually begins to contract down more and more, and that interior of unfused helium begins to rise in temperature and eventually does achieve 100 million degrees. That's the trigger point for helium to begin fusing into carbon and oxygen. And to that story we'll return next week. You know, you know, Mike, you haven't been hurt by that, doing homework that wasn't assigned for no credit. You feel better because of it. And, you know, that reminds me of a very famous case that every first-year law student reads, Hammer versus Dagenhart. And it was a case of a young man who was promised by his rich uncle $5,000 if he would not smoke until he graduated from college. And he didn't. He suffered, but he persevered. After he graduated, he came to his uncle. This is 100 years ago, so $5,000 was much more than it is today, be the equivalent of, who knows what, $50,000 today. And he came to his uncle, and his uncle refused to give him the check. So he sues him. Can you believe that? And a court ruled in favor of the uncle. It has to do with the contract principle of consideration. Every contract, to be enforceable, requires that each party give something and receive something. And what you give or receive is a legal term that's called consideration. It's a technical term. He argued that his forbearance constituted consideration. My forbearing or refraining from smoking, I suffered, and that was adequate consideration. And the court ruled in that case that it was not. And part of the reason was, you know, he himself was benefited by this, and he didn't do anything other than what he was expected to do, and that was graduate from college. So, you know, it kind of reminds me of your story there, Mike, that doing homework that was not assigned, it's not necessarily of no value, but it is in a contractual sense. Okay, let's go on. Let's pick up where we left off last time in chapter 13. And my intention tonight is to finish chapter 13 and then to get through some portion of chapter 14. I'm sorry, 15. We're skipping chapter 14. Here's the basic story of what's going on in small to medium-sized stars. And really, you could even say large, because I think our sun is a large star. So we're talking about stars here up to 10 to 15 times the size of our sun. So these would be small to fairly large stars. What happens to them? And as we saw last time, what's going on, what's producing the heat in the star is this incredible amount of fusion of those hydrogen protons into helium through a multi-step process. And it turns out that the sun is consuming about 600 million tons of hydrogen every second. At that rate, eventually the sun starts to consume an appreciable amount of that fuel, and it begins to contract. And that affects that equilibrium, that hydrostatic equilibrium, where the force of gravity is perfectly offset, the inward force of gravity, by the outward force of the fusion reaction pressure in the core of the sun. Now, as that hydrogen is eventually consumed, what you're left with at the core of the sun is this helium ash core, the unfused helium, because the temperature of the star is nowhere near the 100 million degrees Kelvin that's required to trigger fusion of helium atoms. It takes much more, much higher temperature to fuse helium, because you're looking now at two protons in the nucleus merging or fusing with two or four more protons. And so you have a much stronger Coulomb force of electrostatic repulsion. Now you've got four or six protons resisting each other instead of one. You need a very high temperature that you're not going to achieve under these circumstances. And so with no fusion occurring in the core, that hydrostatic equilibrium is affected, and there's not enough energy to offset gravitational contraction. So here, again, we see in the core of this star the inert helium core. This is the unfused helium. That's the byproduct of the hydrogen fusion. And that's surrounded by this hydrogen-burning shell. As the star continues to contract, this does heat up the helium core, not enough to trigger fusion reactions, but enough to heat up the hydrogen core or shell surrounding that core and cause fusion reactions to occur there. That increased heat from the core caused by that hydrogen-burning shell begins to radiate outward, causing the unfused hydrogen in that outer shell to fuse and expand, and the heat energy flows out of that burning hydrogen shell into the cool extended envelope of unfused hydrogen, which is too cool out here to be fusing, but it has the effect of pushing that envelope out. The expanding envelope is cooler because it becomes so huge, and that's why it turns red which according to Wien's law, as we've seen, is associated with cooler temperatures. And what happens? A red giant results, a red giant star. They have high luminosity because they're so huge, but they have a fairly low surface temperature due to their great size. And that's why they're up here, the upper right-hand quadrant of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. High luminosity, low temperature. Now, the red giant stars can be, their circumference can be as large as the orbit of some of the inferior planets, such as Mercury, in some cases perhaps even Venus. This is the outcome of just about every small to medium-sized star. 100 times more luminous than the star was on the main sequence. At this stage, when our sun reaches this stage, the Earth obviously is going to be completely fried or incinerated. And that's the star ends up right here on the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram with all the giants. Here we can see a depiction of the sun compared to a supergiant, Chi Cygni, which is hundreds of millions of times bigger than the sun. Now you take a look at Betelgeuse in the Orion constellation, just above the three-star belt of Orion that's very prominent here in the spring. It's a red giant. It's red, again, because its surface temperature is cooler. Let's look at the comparison between Betelgeuse and our sun. In terms of mass, it's 16 times more massive. In terms of radius, it's 500 million miles. That's the orbit of Jupiter, compared to 700,000 miles for the sun. Surface temperature, 5,800 degrees Kelvin for the sun, down to 3,600 degrees for Betelgeuse. And again, why is that? It's expanded so much. The heat is diffused and reduced. Core temperature in the core of the sun, 15 million for our sun, 160 million for Betelgeuse. Luminosity, if our sun is 1, Betelgeuse would be 46,000, so it's 46,000 times more luminous, even though it's only 16 times more massive. Average density of the sun in grams per cubic centimeter is 1.4. For Betelgeuse, it's 1 times 10 to the minus 7th power. Age, according to the current model, most widely accepted model, is 4.5 billion years for the sun, 10 million years for Betelgeuse since it was at the supergiant stage. This was after it left its main sequence life, where it spent 90% of its life. 160 million times bigger than the sun, with a mass that's only 16 times greater, producing a density about 1/10 of a millionth less than the sun, or 1/10,000th the density of air. It's a red-hot vacuum is a good way to look at it. Now, here's a frame that I captured from the planetarium software that I use for to control my telescope. And you can just see here the large number of stars that look kind of reddish. Do you notice those? When I say red, that includes basically orange to red. Very few stars are actually red to our appearance. But, you know, these stars right here, these are all what would be called red stars. Varying shades of orange to red. So the point is, they're very common. But when you see those red stars, just remember, you're always looking at a giant star, a red giant, or a red supergiant. The vast majority of stars in our galaxy are red and very small. They're not visible to us because their luminosity is so low, and much of it is the infrared portion of the spectrum. Those are your red dwarf stars. Here's a picture. You can't really see here because it's too bright, but this is a picture I took of the double star cluster in the constellation Perseus, and here you can definitely see a number of red giant stars in these two star clusters. All right, let's talk about the further evolution of the lower mass stars, up to 10 to 15 times the mass of our sun. And again, these are not what I would call really low mass, because these would be up to fairly large stars. Question? No, this is the natural color, but all of them seem purple. Well, maybe that was probably more in the processing than actual, because believe me, I don't think this picture would have any purple stars. You know, that would be your O-class stars, which are exceedingly rare. There's probably some A-class stars in there that would be whitish-blue, bluish-white. So some of them, that would be a true color. But, you know, the processing is more of an art than a science. And, you know, processing astronomical images, you have total control. You can make things any color you want. So just with the turn of a dial, you know, I could eliminate any bluish hue from that image. Well, do I want to do that? If there's some blue stars in there, I don't. So you just have to tweak it, and it is it's a real challenge. I can tell you, the NASA imagers spend, they say, 100 hours of processing for every 1 hour of image time. And in my case, I'd say it is a lot of images I take are probably average 2 hours. And I probably spend 5 to 10 hours of processing. Probably not as much as I should. Okay, let's talk about this further evolution of the lower mass stars. As that red giant core continues to contract because of the inward force of gravity that's not being offset sufficiently by the, it is to some degree, but not so adequately to form hydrostatic equilibrium. So the outward force of the fusion reactions are weakening and causing that giant star to begin to contract down. What happens? As it becomes more concentrated and dense, the heat increases. And when it reaches 100 million degrees Kelvin, that's almost 200 million degrees Fahrenheit, helium nuclei begin to fuse. That's the trigger point for helium to begin fusing in to carbon. And this is what is known as the triple alpha process. And we don't have to know the details of this, just the basic concept that in the triple alpha process, you've got three helium atoms, each of which has two protons. They come together at 100 million degrees Kelvin, hot enough. There's enough interactions between these nuclei that a fusion event occurs, usually producing carbon with six protons. Sometimes this carbon atom will immediately fuse with one helium atom and produce oxygen with eight protons. So oxygen tends to be fairly common as well as carbon. Triple alpha stage. Again, the red giant stage, the burning hydrogen shell is not hot enough to fuse the helium core. So the helium core begins to shrink, producing more heat. And that's the basic process to understand when we're looking at these different cycles in the life of a star. It's the same in every phase. You've got the fuel being dissipated, this constant tug of war between the outward flow of fusion energy and the inward force of gravity. For 90% of a star's life, it's in a state of pure equilibrium or balance. But eventually, as it begins to burn up that fuel, gravity starts to take over. The star becomes smaller. The core becomes more dense. The temperature rises. And all of a sudden, if it reaches a certain temperature, that will trigger fusion of heavier elements. And that's exactly what we're seeing here at the triple alpha stage. Alpha refers to the helium nucleus. Triple, meaning there's three helium nuclei that come together to form one carbon atom. And a carbon plus a helium will produce one oxygen atom. So now we have two areas of nuclear fusion burning, two burning shells, the triple alpha core at the middle, which is beginning to fuse, and that's surrounded by that burning shell of hydrogen. The resulting ash that's left over after the triple alpha process is the carbon and the oxygen. And the star isn't anywhere close to the 600 million degrees Kelvin it needs to be for those elements to begin fusing into heavier elements. Gravity again overcomes fusion, and the star shrinks, getting hotter and less luminous. Okay, the helium in the core is depleted during the fusion reactions, producing the inert carbon-oxygen ash core surrounded by those two burning shells. The first burning shell is the helium shell, and that is surrounded by the hydrogen burning shell. And as that helium shell continues to fuse, the resulting carbon that it produces ends up in the middle where the temperature is not hot enough for it to fuse. So you have basically an inert carbon and oxygen core, and it shrinks, the temperature increases, and that again continues the fusion reactions in those two burning rings, and then the star begins to expand and resume the red giant stage briefly at a slightly higher temperature and luminosity. But that helium is quickly depleted, and the fusion stops, and the core shrinks, gets hotter, but doesn't reach anywhere close to the 600 million degrees Kelvin required for that inert carbon and oxygen core to itself begin fusing into heavier elements and to hold off the inward force of gravity. So what happens at this point is really remarkable. You have what astronomers call the core envelope separation, where the internal core continues to shrink down until it is suddenly and abruptly stopped by what is called electron degeneracy. We introduced that topic last week. That is what's happening. It's also referred to sometimes as the Pauli exclusionary principle. Here you have the electrons, orbits, literally coming in contact with one another. That is a powerful and formidable barrier to further contraction. Because under that Pauli exclusionary principle, it says that electrons cannot occupy the same orbit. And that's the basic principle behind so much of what we're accustomed to. As I said last week, why are you sitting in your chair and not falling through the chair through the floor? Why am I standing here? Why can you put things on the desk and they don't fall through to the center of the earth? The Pauli exclusionary principle. When I put this pointer on the desktop here, why is it stopping? Electron orbits are in contact, and they're stopping. They're setting up a barrier to further collapse. That's what's happening. That's why we have elements other than hydrogen. The periodic table of elements exists because of the Pauli exclusionary principle. When Jesus walks through the wall on Easter Sunday, or it wasn't Easter Sunday, what day was it, Dr. Horton? We have an expert. When did Jesus come to visit the disciples? Okay, so when he walks through the wall, would that have been on Easter Sunday? Okay, there you have the official answer. but he ranks me. But anyway, you know, so God has all of these forces to deal with. And is it possible that he suspends one force, he suspends the Pauli exclusionary principle to allow his son to walk through a wall? It's interesting, interesting concept. But that's what's happening here. That same principle that produces the elements, that prevents you from falling through the earth or your chair or me through the floor here, is that the same principle that causes the collapsing star here to stop at what's called the white dwarf stage. Electron orbits in contact, that's called electron degeneracy, degenerate electrons, and that is a powerful force that resists any further contraction. It's abruptly stopped at that stage. The star becomes a white dwarf and it blows away the outer envelope that we've been looking at. This orange area here and some of the burning shells are blown outward forcefully and illuminated by the hot white dwarf star that remains behind. And the result is, in my opinion, probably the most beautiful object in the universe, and that's a planetary nebula. I'll show you a few pictures I've taken of planetary nebulae, and then I'll show you some taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. And what I think you'll see is, there are hardly any two of these things that look alike. There's a great variety between planetary nebulae, and that's one of the great riddles in astronomy today, is why is there such diversity in the appearance of these nebulae? They all occur in the same way. The white dwarf star, by the way, which may have been the size of our sun or slightly bigger or smaller, it condenses down into an area the size of the Earth, so about a million times shrinkage. Same mass shrunk down to the size, a millionfold to the size of our Earth. One teaspoon would weigh 10 tons of a white dwarf star. Why are they called planetary nebulae? They have nothing to do with planets. They're called this because they look like planets when they were first discovered. Let me show you a picture I took. One of the first pictures I took. Well, it's not. It'll be the next slide, I think. Let me go through this slide. First, gravitational contraction halted by electron degeneracy. The electrons fill all the orbits. No more contraction possible. The equilibrium that results in the white dwarf stage is not maintained by outward fusion reactions, but by the great pressure exerted by those electrons, the electron degeneracy, it's called. That's the outward pressure. That's the barrier that prohibits gravity from crushing that star into a smaller volume. There's no nuclear reactions occurring. Because again, remember the fundamental point, the temperature in the core of the white dwarf is nowhere close to the 600 million degrees needed for carbon to begin fusing. The white dwarf star has a predicted long life cycle of hundreds of billions of years. This is the way that most small to medium and really to large stars, as far as I'm concerned, end their lives quietly as white dwarfs, surrounded initially by a beautiful planetary nebula. These nebulae are probably on average about a light year in diameter. They're expanding at a rate of about 20 to 30 kilometers per second. And at that rate, eventually, over time, they become so diffuse that we can't see them anymore. And if it's just the first few years of a planetary nebula, it's too small for us to see. So they've got to be at a fairly critical stage in their expansion for them to be visible from Earth. Most astronomers believe that that age is about 50,000 years old. If it's much older, they're too spread out for us to see. If they're much younger, they're too small to see. As it turns out, a large number of these are visible. And so the conclusion is they're a very common phenomenon, as we would expect, since this is the way the vast majority of stars end their lives. Okay, here, by the way, here's an example of a white dwarf star, one of the first ever detected. This is Sirius A. It's the brightest star in the sky. And here we have Sirius B, which is a white dwarf star. This picture was taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. So this star is about the size of our Earth. Now, here's a picture I took of the blue snowball, which is an example of a planetary nebula. So you can see, initially, with lower power telescopes, astronomers gave these objects the title planetary nebulae, because they kind of look like planets, don't they? In fact, this object here, looking at this through my 20-inch reflector telescope, you just about fell off the ladder. It was so unbelievable. You're not accustomed to seeing vivid, brilliant color through a telescope. Hardly any color at all. But then you find this object, and here's this brilliant blue ball. That was a great object to view through a large aperture reflector telescope. Here's the picture I took, I showed you last week, that won the Picture of the Day Award by Astronomy Magazine just a week ago, of the Ring Nebula. This is another example of a planetary nebula. There's the internal white dwarf star that blew up, and it's now about the size of the Earth, and this is the outward envelope that's being blown away by the energy from that explosion. Here's a picture I took probably 4 months ago of what's called the Eskimo Nebula. This is another example of a planetary nebula. As we go through these, just kind of remember, have I seen anything like this before, or are these totally unique in each case? There's the Saturn Nebula with the two antennae. There's the Helix Nebula in Aquarius. It's like the double helix of the DNA. Here's the Dumbbell Nebula in the constellation Vulpecula. Again, no two of these look alike. There's the Owl Nebula in the near the Big Dipper. These are all pictures I've taken from my driveway. Now, let's take a look at some planetary nebula images taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. That's one of my favorites. I'm telling you, these are bizarre. How about this one? Again, be thinking of the question, have I seen anything like this before? Or are these all completely unique? There's the Ring Nebula, Hubble Space Telescope. Iris Nebula. There's the Eskimo, taken by the Hubble. The Ant Nebula. Here you can just see the explosive outward force of that nebula. Different colors, different shapes, different geometric configurations. These are all planetary nebulae. Well, would planets be obliterated if something like this happened? Keep in mind, this is after the red giant stage. So those planets have been incinerated out to the distance of Jupiter in our solar system. So Uranus and Neptune would not necessarily be incinerated. Would they survive? Yes, they would survive. Keep in mind, the white dwarf star is the same mass as what the red giant star was. So Uranus and Neptune will continue to be orbiting about the white dwarf at pretty much the same place. Would the force of the explosion? Well, keep in mind, at this stage, you're looking at 1 or 2 light years. So the whole solar system would be engulfed by this nebula. Now, keep in mind, the nebula is it's a tiny fraction of the most perfect vacuum that we can achieve on Earth. So just the fact that you're, you know, surrounded by the nebula portion of a planetary nebula is not necessarily going to be fatal to you. Okay? In fact, it's questionable whether you'd even be able to see it from where you are, let's say from Uranus. But keep in mind, if this is our sun, and this has a radius of 1 light year, Neptune would be about here. So the whole solar system will be engulfed in that nebula. That's not the problem. The problem is the red giant stage, and that happened long before. Okay, let's take a look here at a few clues as to what might be going on here. Different shapes of planetary nebula. To some extent, I think we know this much. They're probably based on our line of sight. So if we're looking, you know, if we're looking straight down from this orientation, if this is the planetary nebula down here with the central star, we're going to see it more like this, aren't we? Whereas if we're looking at it like this, from this angle, we're going to see it more like this image here. And from this angle, looking at it straight through here, it's going to appear more like a ring structure. However, that is just a very crude understanding, and the precise nature of this is unknown. The basis for the great variety of these shapes is not well understood today. Let's summarize what we've learned about white dwarf stars. These are stars with a final mass of 1.4, no greater than 1.4. It's actually, I think, 1.44 solar masses. Now, that's with an end mass of 1.4 solar masses. The initial size of a star like this might have been 7.5 solar masses, the initial mass. An inert carbon core collapses. The star becomes degenerate because of those electrons. Our orbits are coming in contact, and it's prohibiting any further contraction, Pauli exclusionary principle. The final size of a 1 solar mass white dwarf is about the size of our Earth, 1/1,000,000th the volume of the sun. As I said, a teaspoonful might weigh in the neighborhood of 10 tons, still considered gaseous. Why? Those basketballs are being moved from thousands of miles apart to maybe tens of miles apart, those protons. The size of the white dwarf, this is important, is inversely proportional to the mass of the star, inversely proportional. So the more mass of the star, the smaller the white dwarf. Okay, now why is that? Because of the gravity. It's forcing it to contract further and further and further. Let's look at this graph here. It's inversely proportional. So if you look at a solar radii on this axis, and here is the mass and solar masses down here, we see that the larger the mass, okay, the smaller the radius. Until you reach 1.4 solar masses, and the radius becomes zero. So as the mass of the white dwarf approaches 1.4, the radius gets shorter and shorter and shorter over here on this axis. At 1.4,
1.4 times the mass of our sun, the radius becomes zero. This is what's called the Chandrasekhar limit, named after Subramanian Chandrasekhar, who was a famous Indian astronomer and astrophysicist, born in 1910, and he created this limit, just jotting it down on some notebook paper on a trip, actually. He was taken from India to Cambridge University, where he was studying under a prominent astronomer, where he would be. He won the Nobel Prize for this discovery about 50 years later, and he was kind of miffed by that because he thought that his later work was much more significant than this. So 1.4 solar masses, that's the greatest mass that a white dwarf can have, and it corresponds to an initial mass of closer to maybe 7 or 8 solar masses. Stars with initial mass of 7 or more solar masses or greater do not become white dwarfs, but because they have sufficient gravity to crush through that electron degeneracy stage that acts as a barrier. When the gravity reaches a certain level, and that's 1.4 solar masses of the size of that remaining star, it has enough mass to crush through that stage, and one of two things is going to happen: a neutron star or a black hole, as gravity overcomes the electron degeneracy. In a white dwarf, there's no fusion going on. The temperature's not high enough for that inert core of carbon and oxygen largely to fuse. And yet the white dwarf can remain in that stage for billions, some would say hundreds of billions of years, because that heat, the residual heat from the contraction, is captured in such a small volume, 1/1,000,000th or more, the initial size, the surface area becomes so small that it can't radiate heat away sufficiently or quickly, and so it's on a slow cooling curve, a white dwarf star. The final stage of a white dwarf is a black dwarf, which is that Earth-size white dwarf star that is now burned up. And by the way, what happens to carbon when it's under extreme heat and pressure for a long period of time? Turns into a diamond. So the theory is, at the black dwarf stage, you're going to have Earth-size diamonds. Here's an artist's conception. Start mining that. See what happens with the price of diamonds. But here's the result of a star up to 10 to 15 times the size of our sun that has contracted down and heated up in the core, producing the bloated red giant star. But that core, if the star is no bigger than 15 times the size of our sun, that remaining ash core of largely carbon and oxygen, the temperature of the core doesn't achieve a high enough temperature for fusion to occur. And so you have this carbon, largely carbon core that eventually becomes a white dwarf and remains under extreme pressure and heat for a lengthy period of time. And likely a giant diamond like this will result. That's not going to be visible for probably tens of billions of years, however. Now let's take a quick peek at how heavy stars end their lives. Now, heavy stars are rare stars. Very few stars are heavy because they just burn up their fuel too fast. And so when we look at stars much bigger than 10 to 15 times the size of our sun, I want you to understand that is a very rare star in the universe. But let's take a look at the current model of what happens to stars of that size. Stars above the Chandrasekhar limit of an ending mass of 1.4 solar masses don't become white dwarfs. They end their lives in violent explosions. They have enough mass to contract down through the electron degeneracy stage and fuse heavier and heavier elements. Let's take a look at how this works. So in the typical star, the gravity is forcing the mass inward, and nuclear energy is forcing it outward, and you have hydrostatic equilibrium, as we've seen with the smaller stars. Now, the next stage is the hydrogen is consumed, the nuclear energy decreases, the gravity crushes the star inward, and the temperature rises above 100 million degrees Kelvin. Remember, we're talking about large stars now, probably larger than 10 to 15 times initially the size of our sun. That's a sufficient temperature for the helium to produce carbon and oxygen. And so far, this is the exact sequence of events that happens in small to medium-sized stars. Okay? The difference occurs now, because with the larger star, they're big enough that as they contract down further, the gravity crushes the star further, the temperature rises to a sufficient degree of about 600 million degrees for the carbon to begin fusing, the carbon and oxygen, and forming neon and magnesium. This doesn't happen in the smaller to medium-sized stars. This is a rare event. It only happens in the largest stars that have the mass for this to happen. And then with the added outward pressure of the neon and magnesium fusion, you have temporary equilibrium. And once the neon and magnesium, they're not consumed, but they begin to be consumed enough that gravity again begins to take over. That heats up the core, and that begins to reach a trigger temperature high enough, in this case, for silicon and sulfur to be produced through fusion. It's the same process we see over and over. What results is an onion-like surface of this particular star. At each stage, you do achieve temporary equilibrium. And as those elements are burned up through fusion, not entirely, but significantly, there's a reduction in the outward pressure. The star contracts. The temperature increases high enough to fuse heavier elements. And that is the process that goes on and on until the silicon and sulfur produce iron. It turns out that the strong nuclear force or the binding energy peaks with iron. And so that means that there's no further fusion possible beyond iron, atomic number 26. There's no higher, heavier elements that can be achieved through fusion reactions. And since iron is not going to fuse at these temperatures, there's no outward force that is opposing the inward force of gravity. This is the end of the line in stellar evolution right here for your large stars. And what happens? Gravity suddenly begins to contract down in really an explosive contraction, taking a fraction of a second. It just blows right through that degenerate electron stage where the white dwarf was able to hold off the force of gravity with a star no more than 1.4 times the solar mass. When we're looking at bigger stars now, larger than 1.4 solar masses, they can crush right through that degenerate electron stage. When density reaches about 400 billion times the density of water, those degenerate electrons actually merge under the current model with protons, with bachelor protons, and form neutrons. And this happens very suddenly. As I say, the star will shrink to a diameter of 6 to 12 miles in a fraction of a second, traveling at about one-fourth the speed of light. It's an unbelievable process. This is the current model. This has never been seen, but this is what is predicted. We have seen countless examples of the results of this process, and we'll see some of those tonight after the fact, but we've not seen this actual contraction in real time. The neutrons, largely because of this process up here, the density is so great, you've got electrons merging with protons to form neutrons. You've got this sea of neutrons. And they become so numerous that many are forced out of the nuclei of atoms and become degenerate neutrons, just like the electrons were degenerate in the white dwarf stage. It turns out that the degenerate neutrons have a much stronger repulsive force than degenerate electrons. And they're able to withhold the inward crushing force of gravity so long as the initial or the final mass of the star is no more than probably 3 solar masses. not a whole lot bigger. And at that point, the neutron degeneracy stops the contraction in its tracks. At a size of 10 to 20 kilometers, 6 to 12 miles in diameter, you've got this solid crust, maybe 2 kilometers deep, surrounding this vast fluid core of neutrons that has the density of an atomic nucleus. If the core has a final mass of 1.4 to 3 solar masses, which may have been an initial mass of somewhere between 12 and 40 solar masses, it ends up as a neutron star. The outward force, the barrier of the neutron degeneracy stops gravity. And just think of this. Gravity is the weakest of the fundamental forces. In fact, it's 1 in 10 to the 40th power, 1 times 10 to the 40th power weaker than the strong nuclear force or electromagnetism. And that's one of the reasons you can put that paper on your refrigerator held by a simple magnet and overcome the force of the Earth's gravity. And as that star is imploding at a fourth the speed of light, and suddenly it hits that neutron degeneracy stage and is stopped dead in its tracks, there's an explosive rebound that produces two things: a supernova eruption and a neutron star. If the mass is greater than 3 solar masses, the gravity is going to be strong enough to crush down through the neutron degeneracy stage, and there's no force in the universe that's going to stop the weakest force of all, gravity, from inexorably crushing that star out of existence, forming a black hole. A teaspoon of a neutron star, roughly 1 billion tons. A neutron star, as I said, has the density of an atomic nucleus. Tremendous nuclear energy is swept away by the neutrinos unleashed by this explosion. In fact, 10 to the 46th watts, 10 to the 46th power watts, for a few seconds, the energy of a supernova has more energy than all the stars, think about this, all the stars in the universe combined. The bounce created by that sudden stopping of the core collapse, plus the outward force of those neutrinos, thrusts the outer layers of that star explosively outward at about half the speed of light, spewing heavy elements outward. It's what's called a type 2 supernova explosion. Rivals a small galaxy of up to maybe 10 billion stars in luminosity for several weeks or a few months. A neutron star remains at the center after the supernova erupts of, like I say, 6 to 12 miles in diameter. It also spews those neutrons and the exploding layers of heavier elements surrounding that initial star, producing heavier elements because of the incredible amount of energy involved in that explosion. And it turns out that is the only mechanism that we now know of to produce the heavier elements, elements heavier than iron. Elements up to iron can be accounted for through normal stellar evolution up to, you know, stars of maybe 15 to 40 times the size of our sun. But the only way to account for heavier elements is with the extraordinary heat that comes from the supernova explosion. Gold ring on your finger made from the ashes of an exploding star, because those heavier elements that are produced in that supernova explosion seed the environment, seed the neighborhood with heavy elements that then are absorbed by hydrogen clouds that are forming the protoplanet, that are forming the new proto-solar system and creating heavy metals on those orbiting planets. That's the current model. Supernova within 50 light years and possibly up to 300, this is not well understood, would end life on Earth. So there is some study, obviously, of closer stars to see if any of them we can tell are about to blow up. The closest one was just about 20 years ago in the constellation, the Large Magellanic Cloud. I'll show you a picture of that in a minute. It's estimated that there should be one supernova in our galaxy every 25 to 100 years, 1 to 4 times per century as an average. Or let's average that out to 2 per galaxy per century. However, the last known supernova in our Milky Way galaxy was Kepler's star in 1604. We've detected about 300 supernova remnants. These are very diffuse, very difficult to find. So we look at this chart we've seen many times before of the cosmic abundances of the major elements. And these heavier elements we see here, the only mechanism for creating anything heavier than iron, 26, for example, nickel in this case, would be through a supernova eruption. Everything else on this chart, it turns out, can be accounted for through the fusion reactions occurring in the largest, in large stars. So anything above iron on the periodic table, there's no way to account for it other than through a supernova explosion. Well, the neutron stars we've been talking about are so small that they are extremely difficult to see in any telescope. The Hubble telescope has seen a few. They were first predicted in the 1930s by Walter Bade, who is a German astronomer we'll come back to in Chapter 15. Their presence was eventually detected by radio signals. The first time this happened was in 1967, when a graduate student at Cambridge University by the name of Jocelyn Bell, with a radio telescope she was using, detected this periodic pulsation of about, as I recall, 1 per second. And there was no known phenomenon in the universe that could account for this. And she called it LGM-1, for Little Green Men-1, because she thought that this was a signal from extraterrestrial intelligence. And so she shared it with her professor, supervising professor, and he was absolutely dumbfounded by it as well. And he thought she may be right. This may be an alien civilization communicating with us. So they decided to keep it secret from everybody else so they wouldn't panic the public. Many more were quickly detected, up to 1,000. And so they eventually concluded this must be some physical phenomenon that we're listening to rather than a alien civilization. And these have been given the name pulsars for pulsating radio source. These are neutron stars that we can detect because the radiation being emitted from the star is in our line of sight. However, there's no object that we can see where this noise is coming from, this radiation is coming from. We can't see anything there because they have such low luminosity, we can't see the neutron star itself. It's only 6 to 12 miles in diameter. So you hear this powerful radiation coming at us in a beep, in a periodic pulsation, but we can't see anything there. You can see how this caused people some serious questions 30 or 40 years ago. Here's a comparison of our sun with a neutron star. Our sun rotates about once every month. A neutron star, 1,000 or more times per second. Why is that? Think of it this way. You've got our sun close to 1 million miles in diameter, contracting down to 6 to 12 miles in diameter. You remember the law of conservation of angular momentum. If the mass is conserved and the distance decreases, the velocity of rotation must increase. So this is the skater folding her arms in with a vengeance. You know, 1,000 times per second, this pulsar rotating. Magnetic field, 1 trillion times greater than our sun. Temperature of a neutron star, 1 million degrees compared to the surface temperature of our sun, 5,800 degrees Kelvin. Diameter, as I say, 6 to 12 miles compared to close to 1 million. Escape velocity, if you were to be in or near the star, what would your velocity have to be to escape its gravitational attraction? For our sun, 6 miles per second. That's the escape velocity of the sun from the Earth. It's much higher than that from the sun. But from the surface of a neutron star, your escape velocity would have to be half the speed of light. 93,000 miles per second is what your rocket's going to have to hit for you to escape. Here's an artist's conception of what we're talking about here. The main point to understand with a neutron star is this. that the rotational axis is at right angles with the kind of the magnetic poles, okay? And the magnetic poles are where the radiation is emitted, because the internal radiation, there's all kinds of radiation produced. Just think about it. The radiation produced by a neutron star that's rotating at 1,000 times per second. Remember we said how the moving electrons produce the magnetic fields, produce the electronic field, electric fields, those self-propagating transverse waves. And that's exactly what's happening here. The key point is that the rotational axis is at right angles with the magnetic poles, and it's out of those magnetic poles. The radiation follows the magnetic field lines, and it's ejected from the north and south pole. Like a spinning light, it's called the spinning lighthouse model. Here's the rotational axis. Here's the magnetic fields, poles on either side. And this is what we're going to see from planet Earth if the star is in this orientation. If the axis is tilted this way, we're going to miss it completely. We're not going to hear anything. It's got to be on pretty much our line of sight. The axis of rotation of that star has got to be perpendicular to the plane of that star with our Earth. Here's the lighthouse, comparing the neutron star to the lighthouse. You know, if you're a ship at sea and the light is pointing this way from the lighthouse, you're not going to see anything. And that's the neutron. There's the comparable situation here with the neutron star, with the axis not perpendicular to our line of sight. Now here, when the light is shining directly at you in the lighthouse, this is what it looks like. And the same thing would be true of the pulsar. We hear it when we are in the line of sight of the radiation being emitted from the poles. And keep in mind, those pulses happen twice per revolution, once from the northern pole, once from the southern pole. So you take the total pulses per second, and you divide that by 2, and that equals the actual rotation speed. We'll conclude our first session tonight by having you listen to some pulsars. This was the one that Jocelyn Bell heard. Okay, now let's go to the next one. This next one is the Vela pulsar, rotating 11 times per second. Okay, is that bizarre or what? And now we're looking at the Crab pulsar, 30 times per second. Let's go on to the next one here. This is the pulsar PSR JO437-4715, rotating 174 times per second. I mean, wouldn't that be bizarre to hear that in a radio telescope? Now, let's look at this last one. This is one of the fastest ones ever detected. It rotates 1645, so we're hearing twice that in terms of frequency. What you're listening to, class, is nothing less than a star rotating 645 times per second. Each rotation, because it's perpendicular to our line of sight, each rotation, its rotational axis is perpendicular to our line of sight. Each rotation, we see the north and south magnetic pole, out of which is emanating this intense beam of radiation. So each rotation, we get two beeps. And that's what we're hearing here, is this pulsar. This star, because of the conservation of angular momentum that started out millions of times bigger than our sun, as the mass has remained essentially the same, but the distance has decreased, the velocity goes crazy. Our sun, one revolution per month, neutron star, 1,000 times per second. There's the perfect example of the law of conservation of angular momentum. And we see it here in the frequency of these radiation bursts in a pulsar star. Unknown in 1967 what this was when it was first discovered. Now it's fairly well understood that this constitutes the intense radiation that is multiplied by that incredible magnetic field, a trillion times stronger than our sun. And we're hearing nothing less than the orbit of this bizarre star, a billion tons per teaspoon in weight, rotating at 1,000 times per second, 6 to 12 miles in diameter. The results of a massive star following the supernova explosion. That's a star of up to about 3 solar masses. If it gets much bigger than that, the neutron degeneracy stage is not going to be a sufficient barrier to stop the weakest force in the universe, gravity, from its inexorable march inward into crushing that star out of existence.